Penguin Random House Audio presents Carnegie's Maid by Marie Benedict, read for you by Alana Kerr Collins. Prologue. December 23, 1868. New York, New York. The gentle melody of a Christmas song lifted into the air of his study from the street below. The music did nothing to change his mood or his actions. Ensconced behind the black walnut desk in his luxuriously appointed St. Nicholas Hotel suite, fountain pen in hand, Andrew Carnegie wrote like a madman. He paused, searching for the correct word. Glancing around the study lit by the very latest in gaslights, he saw it as if anew. The walls were hung with a heavy yellow brocade wallpaper, and dark green velvet curtains framed the windows, tied back by heavy gold cords, affording him a fine view of Broadway. He knew this suite was superior to any found in America, or even Europe. Yet this fact, which had so pleased him during his earlier visits to New York, now repulsed him. The curtain's gold cord seemed like binding ropes, and he felt trapped inside a rarefied prison. He had argued with his mother that they should stay elsewhere, somewhere less ostentatious. He longed to reside somewhere that was not haunted by memories of Clara, although he did not say that aloud. It no longer seemed right to stay at the St. Nicholas, not without her. He had spent the better part of a year searching for her, with no success. Not even the detectives, his top security men, or bounty hunters, the best in the business, could locate a hint of her trail. But his mother would have none of it.
Andra!
She called him in her inimitable brogue. The trappings of wealth are the Carnegie's right and due, and by God, we will secure our place. He acquiesced, depleted of the energy to argue. But on their arrival at the St. Nicholas Hotel earlier that day, Andrew had taken the extraordinary step of banishing his mother to her adjoining suite of rooms and ignoring her pleas that they attend a holiday dinner at the Vanderbilts, an invitation to the near highest echelon of New York City society that had been hard won. He needed to be alone with his thoughts of Clara. Clara. He whispered her name, letting it roll over his tongue like a fine cordial. In the privacy of his study, he let his very first memory of her wash over him. Clara had trailed behind his mother into the parlor of Fairfield, their Pittsburgh home, with a step so light that he barely noticed the tap of her shoes or the swish of her skirts as she crossed the room. Her demure manner and averted gaze did nothing to draw his attention until his mother had barked out some order in Clara's direction. Only then, when Clara lifted her eyes and met his square on, did her presence register. In that fleeting moment, before she quickly lowered her eyes again, he witnessed the sharp intelligence that lay beneath the placid demeanor required for a lady's maid. Other, more intimate memories of Clara began to take hold, along with a longing so intense it caused him physical pain. But then a roar of laughter and the clink of crystal glasses from the grand dining room below his study interrupted his reverie. He wondered who might be celebrating in that gilded room. Could it be one of his business colleagues visiting from out of town? Or perhaps one of the elusive Upper Ten families, deigning to leave their cosseted, insular world of brownstone dinners to peer into the latest in sumptuous New York City dining establishments? Should he go downstairs to see? Stop, he chastised himself. This is precisely the sort of status-seeking, greedy thinking that Clara would have loathed. He had vowed to her that he would carve out a different path from those materialistic industrialists and society folk, and he would keep that vow, even though she was gone. He returned to his mission of honoring her, one he'd attempted countless times as he drafted and redrafted this document. Pressing the tip of the fountain pen so hard that the ink bled through the fragile paper, he wrote. 33 and an income of $50,000 per annum. By this time 2 years, I can so arrange all my business as to secure at least $50,000 per annum. Beyond this, never earn. Make no effort to increase fortune, but spend the surplus each year for benevolent purposes. cast aside business forever, except for others. Settle in Oxford and get a thorough education, making the acquaintance of literary men. This will take 3 years active work. Pay a special attention to speaking in public. Settle then in London and purchase a controlling interest in some newspaper, or live review and give the general management of it attention, taking a part in public matters, especially those connected with education and improvement of the poorer classes. Man must have an idol. The amassing of wealth is one of the worst species of idolatry. No idol more debasing than the worship of money. Whatever I engage in, I must push inordinately. Therefore, should I be careful to choose that life which will be the most elevating in its character? To continue much longer overwhelmed by business cares, and with most of my thoughts wholly upon the way to make more money in the shortest time, must degrade me beyond hope of permanent recovery. I will resign business at 35, but during the ensuing 2 years, I wish to spend the afternoons in receiving instruction and in reading systematically. Lifting the pen from the paper, Andrew read. The words were rough and imperfectly formed, but he was satisfied. Although God had willed that he could not have Clara, he would brandish her beliefs like a sword. He would worship the idols of status and money, for their own sake, no longer. Instead, he would amass and utilize reputation and money for one higher purpose only, the betterment of others, particularly the creation of ladders for the immigrants of his adopted land to climb. Through the heavy fog of his despair, Andrew permitted himself the smallest of smiles, the tiniest of appeasements. The letter would have pleased his Clara. Chapter 1. November 4th, 1863. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I shouldn't be here. Cecilia or Eliza could have been swaying on this stinking vessel instead of me. It was their right, Eliza's duty anyway as the eldest daughter, to make the voyage and take the chance on a new land. But Mum and Dad offered a litany of excuses for my sisters. The 21-year-old Eliza was on the brink of a marriage that would allow the family to keep our farm tenancy intact, a status that had eluded me due to my over-cleverness, Dad said. And Cecilia was too young for the voyage at 15, and too weak-spirited in any event. And so, knowing my parents were right, I boarded the envoy in their place. 42 days later, I regretted the preening and arrogance to which I subjected my sisters when I'd learned of my parents' decision. I knew now that being considered my parents' chiefer, their changeling capable of transmuting into whatever America required, was no prize, and I desperately missed my sisters. Light snuck through the hatch into the steerage cabin, blinding me for a moment. My eyes closed spontaneously. Even as the light faded a bit, I chose to keep my eyes shut, surrendering to the remnants of the sun's heat. I wanted the fading rays to burn me clean. I wanted them to burn away the sour smell of the long Atlantic passage and the recurrent tears of leave-taking. The steward clanged the ship's bell to signal our disembarking. I opened my eyes and reluctantly glanced around the cabin. Mothers with listless infants in their arms pushed themselves to standing, while their older, hollow-eyed children clung to their skirts, scared by the relentless ringing of the bell. Fathers and old men struggled to smooth their filthy, rumpled suits into some sad approximation of dignity. Only the few young men, the fear Oga, were strong enough and eager enough to readily form a queue. The journey had been rough, taking its toll on even the fear Oga. Nearly 3 weeks prior, after an already tumultuous crossing, a storm hit the envoy, tumbling those of us in steerage out of our beds into a hold with 2 feet of water. As the crew and my fellow passengers began working the pump in the pitch dark of the moonless night, the ship began rolling from side to side like the heavy log it was, causing one Dublin girl of about 16, traveling alone like myself, to crash into one of the wooden posts keeping the ceiling firm above our heads.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?